that somehow has life of its own.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour. Today is January 29th. My name is Sarah Jesmer.
And I'm Brian Jefferson.
And we will be your hosts today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Ganigahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. CKUT is broadcasting from Jojage, or so-called Montreal.
On the show today, we'll walk through news you need to know from the past week and hear from an organizer from a vigil honoring those lost in the 2017 Quebec City mosque attack.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back with some headlines.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
First, some news. A vigil was held in Milton Park this morning for Raphael Napa Andre. That street intersection on Milton and Park Avenue is the site of a memorial to the 51-year-old Niskapi Inu man. Andre was part of the homeless community and died steps away from a closed shelter recently. His family is reported to remember Andre as a strong person who was always generous and had inextricable ties to the land. Community members in Montreal have encouraged people to wear light blue and light a candle in his memory. Andre's death sparked a debate over an exemption for the homeless during Quebec's curfew. A provincial court judge ordered this week that the homeless are exempt from being fined for the next 7 days. The province is expected to officially reevaluate lockdown measures that are set to expire on February 8th.
And McGill students were evicted from their residence earlier this week because, according to the administration, they did not follow social distancing rules. Administration said their exclusion from residences will not exceed 10 days. Students at the university's Royal Victoria Residence are also seeing an outbreak of cases as of this week.
And the Montreal City Council voted Tuesday to back a call to the federal government to decriminalize simple drug possession. The Snowden Independent City Councillor Marvin Rotrand introduced the motion that first gained traction in Vancouver and with Montreal grassroots support networks.
I'd like to thank Louis Letellier de Saint-Just from Cactus, who was a guide for me in this file and put me in touch with medical specialists and groups that are frontline in the field.
This is Rotrand at Tuesday's meeting.
I'm a middle-class guy who doesn't use drugs. I don't even think I know anybody who uses drugs, although you never know. And I had a lot of questions, and the answers were very, very convincing. When something doesn't manifestly work, you've got to change it. When the government of Canada says there's an epidemic with 17,000 deaths in the last 4 years, and a lot of them in the last 6 months, and that COVID is making the whole situation, drugs and dependency, worse, I think we have to listen. We cannot be insensitive to the harm that is happening to our fellow citizens.
The motion was adopted, and focus now goes to the federal government to act on decriminalization.
And as of Friday morning, there are 83 active cases of COVID among incarcerated people at the St. Jerome Detention Facility. According to Quebec's daily count this morning, 16 staff are also actively infected. St. Jerome is just north of the island of Montreal. Outbreaks like these mean inmates are confined to their cells for almost 24 hours of the day. This is one of the largest outbreaks of COVID-19 cases in a detention facility in the province. Quebec, Alberta, and Manitoba have not yet communicated a timeline for when people in their prisons will be vaccinated. And the city apologized this week to the Hasidic community, who says they were confused about the details of restrictions on places of worship. The Quebec government made multiple contradicting statements concerning limits on public gatherings 3 times in 48 hours in the last few days. Premier Legault clarified in a press conference this week that 10 people can gather in places of worship.
Now more than ever, the simplest gestures are our best protection to fight the virus. That's why we need to continue following basic health measures, such as keeping a 2-meter distance from others, wearing a mask and washing our hands regularly. Avoid travel and non-essential trips. And if you develop symptoms, be sure to get tested promptly and follow self-isolation guidelines. See all of the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. My name is Sarah Jesmer. The time is just after 5 p.m., which means Montrealers are gathering right now up near Park Metro. They're remembering people lost in a 2017 Quebec City attack on Muslim worshippers. Ihab Lotaieff was one of the people who organized tonight's vigil.
And I am a co-founder of Muslim Awareness Week. The vigil today we're having, the in-person vigil, is really only one of many vigils, commemoration events, remembrance events that are happening all across the province, many of them in Montreal, but all the others are happening virtually online. We decided that we need to have something in person to give those who want to come in person and connect, at least by sight, because we will be respecting social distancing. But to those who want to be there physically somewhere, we decided to have this vigil in person. It's going to be a short and sweet event at the same location where there was the big, huge gathering of support on January 30th in 2017, the night right after the massacre. So we're going to have it at the same place to keep the tradition and the memory continuing.
And what year did you start Muslim Awareness Week?
I have been organizing with Muslim Awareness Week for the past 3 years. Muslim Awareness Week started as an idea to take the commemoration of what happened in 2017 beyond just empathy and remembering, but to take it to a next level, which would try to deal with the core causes that led to the hate that eventually led to the loss of life and this tragic event that we saw in January 29, 2017. So Muslim Awareness Week is not limited to commemoration events. It goes far beyond that. It does a lot of work to bring people closer to each other, to have the community, the Muslim community, present itself to society in the way that it wants to be seen, its natural way, not as it is seen through stereotypes and only media reports. So we wanted to have people, give people the chance to see Muslims as individuals, as groups, as people who contribute to society, who have their concerns, who have their aspirations, who have their worries. They're just normal human beings like him and her, you know, not anything special. So I have been a founder of Muslim Awareness Week and a core organizer for the past 3 years. This year, of course, it's all virtual. And that is when some groups did approach Muslim Awareness Week, suggesting that we have a physical vigil for remembrance, and we accepted right away to be a partner and went ahead and created the Facebook page, and there is a lot of interest in it. I have to tell you that we did not think that we'll get that much interest in it. So I just want to remind people again that even if our numbers are large, the space there is big, and we need to continue to respect social distancing. This is the third installment of Muslim Awareness Week. So 2019 was the first year. So it was actually a reflection on what we had seen in commemorations in 2018 that we appreciated so much, of course, but we did not feel that this alone would resolve and help society move forward. So that is why and how Muslim Awareness Week came into existence. Of course, we are very thankful to our many, many partners from outside the Muslim community who made and are continue to make Muslim Awareness Week possible.
He says the idea behind the week is to meet people where they're at, in a physical or online space.
Community centers, in their literary gatherings, in their churches, synagogues. So we don't wait for people to come to us, but we try to go to people to increase the impact of this outreach and connection and information that we want to give.
Can you explain maybe one or two of the events that you created to get past empathy and to the core of action itself?
Sure, sure. We partnered in one event with the Quebec Writers Federation, for example, where we featured in the event three Muslim writers, three Muslim very different writers. So that's a very concrete example that we want people to see that there's so much diversity. It's not like a homogenous community, as many people think of us as. I think a good example to show what we're talking about as Muslim Awareness Week events.
The federal government announced this week that today, January 29th, will be a National Day of Remembrance. How do you feel about that declaration? And how do you feel today as well?
Of course, I am happy that the day, a day of remembrance, and more importantly, a day of action against Islamophobia. It is something that we have been asking for from the beginning, from year one or from week one, I would even say. But I will reflect also on an article that I wrote in the Huffington Post in 2018, which is around the first anniversary. I was talking to society and to the community and saying that the government will not lead. We have to lead. We have to make it de facto a day of action against Islamophobia, a week of action against Islamophobia, and then the government will follow. That is what happened when the government saw we're working hard to make society more peaceful, more inclusive, to act in a practical way, pragmatic way against Islamophobia. Only then did the government feel ready to act. I think that it is a responsibility on us all to work hard to make society a better place. And I would like politicians who try to use divisions for political gains to really reflect again and again. We have just come out of Trump's 4 years, and we have seen the damage that that has done to the social fabric in the United States. And we hope not to see something similar in Quebec. There are those who, when they see the government act in the way that a denial that it is acting, they become more xenophobic and more racist. Take that into consideration when they are deciding what position to take and what statements to make.
What has changed and what has not changed in the past 4 years from the first time that we observed this day to now?
Over the last 4 years, we have seen both sides increase. The side understanding, empathy, knowledge, openness to the other did increase. On the other hand, the side of xenophobia and digging their heels in the distancing from the other also increased.
He said the Quebec government played a key role in this split in society by introducing Bill 21. Many critics say that the secularism law disproportionately pushes out people who wear head coverings for religious purposes from civil service jobs like teaching.
It is a bill that tried to solve a problem that does not exist just for political gain. And at the end, it gave a lot of ammunition and energy to those who don't want coexistence to happen. I am a staunch supporter of secularism in its balanced, open way. The state should not have or be influenced by religion in any way, but that does not mean that that the state interferes with the individual practice of religion, and does not mean that the state ignores the Quebec and Canadian Charter of Rights. This is a very worrisome situation and can cause a lot of damage, and it should be opposed by all of us, whether we have a stake or not in the jobs affected by Bill 21. I think this is something about the values of our society. And if there is something I can call Quebec values, it is those values that were inscribed in the Quebec Charter of Rights that I received as an immigrant arriving here in 1989.
And how has COVID affected faith communities and Muslim community gatherings in your perspective?
Of course, COVID affected so many people in so many ways that spiritual communities were affected as much. There are so many people. I mean, we are different as humans, again, and as I was saying earlier, we are different as Muslims as well. And in so many spiritual groups, belief groups, some people really are much in need of their spiritual gatherings.
He says he empathizes with all faith groups, like Muslim, Jewish, Buddhist, and Christian communities, for example, because he says COVID restrictions make life just that more difficult.
To those who are missing that, and I'm really hoping that everybody gets a chance to get this spiritual support, religious need fulfilled one way or the other, as this situation keeps prolonging and prolonging month after month.
And lastly, what would you say to Montrealers to pivot to anti-racism and anti-Islamophobia action as we're all semi-isolated from home?
Spread positive information. You can do that. I mean, we are living our life virtually right now, so everything does happen virtually. Don't be tolerant to any hate or abuse you hear directly or indirectly. Try to know the other. There are so many ways to know the other that you are maybe have doubts or thoughts or concerns about. Spread the positive information to those around you if you yourself have it or if you receive it, so that we manage to really overcome the ignorance and the stereotypes that are the base of hate, which in itself is the base where such crimes as what happened 4 years ago are the outcome of.
That was Ihab Lotayef, founder of Muslim Awareness Week and one of the organizers of a remembrance rally happening tonight at Park Metro. That vigil honors Ibrahim Berry, Mamadou Tanu Berry, Khalid Belkacemi, Abu Bakr Thabti, Abdel Karim Hussein, and Azzedine Soufiane, while also standing with survivors and their families.
Hello, dear listeners. As of March 16th, CKUT Studios will be closed until further notice. The programming on our airwaves will consist of a mixture of recent CKUT archives, new pre-recorded segments, and other relevant special programming. Our upcoming funding drive will be postponed until further notice. Thank you for understanding that we are taking these measures to protect the health of our staff and community members. Love, CKUT.
Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm Brian Jefferson. For the next segment of Off the Hour, we're going to tune into a podcast from Pamela Palmater's Lawyer Life Show. Palmater talks with Mary Ellen Turple Lafon about an investigation into racism in the BC healthcare system. We'll be right back at the top of the hour with some of Montreal news you can use.
Welcome back, Warriors. Tunse, Sego, Ani Bouju. Kwe Nin Deluizi Pam Palmater, and I am the host of this show, The Warrior Life. This podcast is a show about living the warrior life, a lifestyle that focuses on decolonizing our minds, bodies, and spirits, while at the same time revitalizing our cultures, languages, traditions, practices, and governing structures. But it's also about asserting, living, and defending our sovereignty all over Turtle Island, and we do that in so many different ways. There's land defenders and water protectors, educators who empower our people, lawyers and advocates who push for justice, elders who share their knowledge, youth who are exercising their voices, leaders of all kinds, elected, traditional, community-based, all of us working towards the same goal. And that includes parents who raise happy, healthy children, and those of us who work inside and outside all of the systems to advance our common objectives. And this podcast is really meant to lift up all of those voices and honor their hard work. And today, I'm super honored to have my friend Mary Ellen Turple Lafon. I have followed her work forever. She's literally a tireless advocate for Indigenous peoples, and she has worked in most, if not all, of these positions. I mean, she's a lawyer. She was the first First Nation judge appointed to the Provincial Court of Saskatchewan. She was the child and youth advocate in BC, and now she's a professor and probably most well known as a very reputable and credible independent investigator into a wide range of issues. Her work has earned her many honors and awards, including Time Magazine's 100 Global Leaders of Tomorrow in 1994, and then again in 1999 as Time Magazine's Top 20 Leaders for the 21st Century. She has done an incredible amount of work in a relatively short period of time. I am so honored that you joined us here on this podcast. Welcome to the show, Mary Ellen.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Professor Palmater, for having me. I'm so happy to be on the show and really honored to speak with you and, of course, to support all of your important work and your viewers and listeners who need to get accurate information and need to understand how we address the most important issues facing us as First Nations people today.
Well, thank you for that, because I think that's also an important reminder. There's so much noise out there in media and social media, and there's so much political rhetoric. It's actually hard sometimes just to zero in on the facts and what do those facts mean and how do we deal with those. So it's I think it's really important that you're here today to talk about lots of things, but also a recent report that you did.
I did, and I think the issue about focusing on the facts is really important. And, you know, what tends to happen, and we've seen this recently, like with the constant misinformation and in fact racism that we've seen around residential schools and the responses that people have, like it's not fact driven. And so this recent report that I did for the government of British Columbia, the health minister, but also the First Nations leadership and Métis leadership, wanted a really complete look at whether or not racism exists in the BC healthcare system and what does it look like, right? So that was a fact-finding investigative process. It wasn't just, oh, I'm gonna write an opinion piece. It wasn't just a piece of advocacy. It was a really thorough investigative report that, you know, I engaged with more than 9,000 British Columbians. And I opened a 1-800 number that received 600 cases. This was in a 4-month period. And then I reviewed 185,000 data sets, if you like, or points involving people getting healthcare, like, so looking at what happened in emergency rooms for Indigenous people. So you look at everything and then you assess it. And that's what led to the report in plain sight that found that, you know, that not only is there racism in the healthcare system in BC, but even how we talk about it and think about it and the words that are used sometimes they can just be slogans. Like people will say, oh, we promote cultural safety and humility. And it's a slogan that I heard repeated. Yet then when I started to go into the cases and look at them and look at the information that came even from healthcare workers, it's clear that they have no concept of what these are. So concepts like, what is racism? What is direct racism? What is indirect racism? What is prejudice? What is bias? What are the main stereotypes that are like circulating in the BC healthcare system? And then how does that lead to discrimination? These are systems that you have to really take apart. But what was quite staggering to me, even in BC, where we've had, you know, a First Nations Health Authority, we've done a lot of work in British Columbia to address the colonial history that has so harmed people. But even here in British Columbia, the concepts, when someone said, they'll just say, well, I'm not a racist. And you're like, well, no, that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about whether you're a racist. We're talking about, are there racist stereotypes? And would you even know one if you saw it, by the way? Because I have 600 people who have just given me cases. And in every single instance, they have identified very clearly and accurately a prejudice, a stereotype, and the kind of harm they experienced, and then said to me, I tried to bring it forward. There's no point bringing it forward because that system just gets defensive. So you're right, like we have to come down to facts and evidence. And so, you know, this is a 200-page report. I'm about to release a data report, which looks at all of the issues around data. And I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk about what I learned about women, for instance, the disproportionate discrimination against women. But people often think, and I know you probably experienced this in your own life experience in research, Pam, people often think, oh, racism is something that's a rural and remote problem. Like it's a small town remote problem. It's not in our big cities. It's not in our big premier hospitals or whatever. And in fact, what the review found was there's no statistically significant difference between those prejudices operating in our premier so-called world-class hospitals as they are in our rural and remote urgent care clinics. And that in of itself, just that finding of itself, led to a lot of recognition in BC that their assumptions about what is racism, the conversation about anti-racist tools, we have to shift our conversation into anti-racism tools. Like it, the word racism has to be used, it has to be unpackaged. And in healthcare in particular, the dialogue has to become much more accurate around what's actually happening on the ground at the point of care where people seek care.
Well, I think that's really important. It seems simple, you know, the concept of really unpacking what is racism, what is systemic racism, what happens when it's, you know, direct and indirect. But when I work with people and, you know, some in the medical profession across the country, some of them still hold this view that racism is some kind of overt hatred, that I'm calling people names, that I'm, you know, specifically treating them in a certain way, and not realizing that if you fail to treat someone who presents with a medical issue to you because you make the assumption that they're drunk or that they're just doing it for gratuitous purposes, that is not racism. That's somehow a valid medical assessment, not realizing that you've only made that assessment based on stereotypes. And I think the work that you're doing will go a long way towards really getting through, because what hospital doesn't have some kind of diversity and inclusion, or, you know, racism plan, or, you know, all of this cultural safety stuff? I mean, I think they probably all have it, but do they understand any of those components?
No, and I think you're right. And, you know, there's an infographic I use in the report, and I know you're going to link it and make it available to your listeners or your viewers. It's it really shows sort of how these things relate, right? And how people get so mixed up. So the first thing that infographic does, and I'll just speak to it briefly, is it actually shows what are the main stereotypes. Like what are the 8 top stereotypes? And I have to give a trigger warning when I talk about this, because for First Nations, Métis, or Inuit listeners, this is triggering. And, you know, we do have mental health supports available. People go to the report. There are supports because I'm talking about British Columbia, but I believe this is a national problem. And I believe that there will be, you know, the top stereotypes might be different elsewhere. They might be, you know, more, but I just want to say that we have to talk about them. So it's very triggering, and I recognize that, and it's important to get support, but it's important to validate, right? So I'm talking about it from the perspective of validate. So the most important thing, like, is the context setting, and I know you do so much work in this area in your advocacy and your as an educator and as a leader, Pam, and that is to understand the deeply colonial history of healthcare, right? It was a segregated system with Indian hospitals, just like residential schools were, you know, a genocidal policy to destroy the Indian child connection to their language and identity. A lot of those kids in those residential schools got sent to the Indian hospitals where they never saw their families, with substandard care, the TB hospitals. Then the Indian hospitals themselves, I mean, I had cases during this review where there were people that saw a veterinarian, not even a doctor, because that's what you got during the Indian affairs pathway of healthcare. So we have to always remember, like, in the Indian hospitals, and the people that worked in the Indian hospitals were trained at our number one schools, the universities of Toronto, the UBCs. People didn't just come from nowhere. They were trained there. There were people that did medical experiments on Indigenous children. There are people that did medical experiments on genetic material from Indigenous people without consent, which continues to be, like, in recent memory, right? Living memory. In British Columbia, the Indian hospitals, like one of them, which is in Nanaimo, you know, the Sonamo people, they have like four little postage stamp reserves. On one of their little reserves, they have a graveyard with unknown people that died in that hospital that aren't even from their nation. To this day, they're there. We don't even know. The history of the Indian hospital is something, the colonial history is something we've yet to grapple with those records and that experience. So what I found, first of all, was that history of segregated care, meaning less than care because First Nations didn't deserve proper care, is entrenched. And people in our system, their parents or grandparents may have worked in that system, or gone to schools that just normed, well, you're going to work in the Indian hospital. Like, you know, so I just have to always talk about, where do we come in? We come in through this lens of colonialism, eradication of Indigenous people, or less treatment. Like, it's so entrenched. So people say, oh, that's in the past. Or like they used to say about residential school, just get over it. Although maybe some conservative leaders still say that. You should just get over it. I'm like, sorry, we can't just get over something that caused these barriers. So that's the first piece, I would say, Pam. Like, for BC, we looked at all the history of Indian hospitals. And when I was interviewing docs, nurses, leaders in the healthcare field, there were people that still didn't know about Indian hospitals that are working today. They might be running a college, you know? So you come in through that door, and I would say, Pam, when you get into that door, then you get into the point of care, all of the investigation found these top eight stereotypes. Okay, and I'm going to name them. As I said, they're triggering, but I'm going to name them. Indigenous people, was primarily directed at First Nations people, are viewed as less worthy. They're viewed as drinkers, alcoholics. So the stereotypes include suggesting that First Nations people are drug seeking, bad or neglectful parents, non-compliant. They're a lot, often called frequent flyers, less capable, that they get stuff for free, and a lot of misogynistic views of women. So a lot of views, like I tell the story of an Indigenous woman that went to see a urologist for persistent UTIs on urinary tract infections, and the urologist is very rough with her during the process, and she complains and says, like, this actually hurts. And then the urologist says, well, I thought you Native women like it rough. And so that's an example. There's a lot of layering of views about Indigenous women being sexually available, being sex workers, having certain, like, sexually available or devalued, having too many children, not caring for their children, not understanding why they have so many children, where's their partners, So these are the top, what I call stereotypes in the BC healthcare system. And I think they probably are pretty common in across Canada. But what's important, Pam, is that those stereotypes lead to something, which is direct interactions at the point of care that are discrimination. So what people don't understand is stereotypes, the beliefs that people carry around, lead to discrimination. What does discrimination look like? Let me describe what I found, okay? It looks like abusive interactions. And I've just given you the abusive, physically and verbally abusive interaction with a woman seeking care from a urologist in a hospital. It also leads to denial of service, like, oh, you're drug seeking, so we're not going to help you. When in fact, I had patients come forward who actually had a stroke. They weren't drug seeking. Or I tell the story in the report of a 10-year-old girl with epilepsy. Her mom brings her to the hospital and they keep interrogating her that she's been drinking. Are you drinking? Are you drunk? Are you drinking? To the point where mom takes the child and leaves the hospital, and the child's epilepsy meds are off kilter, but they're constantly there's a barrage of, you must be drunk, you must be drunk. And they're like, what are you talking about? I'm 10 years old. So that leads to this denial of service, ignoring and shunning, inappropriate pain management, this whole concept that you're drug seeking, so therefore you're tough, you can live with the pain. Or you're detoxing, so you're sobering up, so get over it, you're not getting your pain meds. Leads to medical mistakes because you don't listen to what the Indigenous person is saying, because you're so full of stereotypes and attitudes that you cannot hear them. So it's not like, we use the word not culturally safe communication. This is far from culturally safe. And then of course, disdain for cultural healing. And I would just say on that one, disdain for cultural healing, that really escalated me personally, Pam, when I looked at it. I had one case of a woman, she was very close in age to me, in her 50s. She was in the hospital, her daughter was with her. She put cedar behind her hospital bed, because that's an Indian medicine. She wanted to have it present. It wasn't interfering. It was on the wall behind her bed. The nurse came in and took it down and threw it in the garbage and said, we don't allow that here. And that was one of many instances where people would say, like, I have my traditional practices, my medicines, my views. So not just the question of like, oh, that's interesting, what does that mean to you? How do you use it? Which would be a respectful conversation. We do have like complementary Chinese medicine, for instance, in BC. But with the Indigenous medicine was literally pulled down, thrown in the garbage, and the marched out. And the mom and the daughter were like, that's not respectful. And like, well, sorry, we don't have that here. So it was really hard to explain to healthcare workers at times, like, that is discrimination. So when you have those stereotypes and discrimination, it's exactly what you said earlier, Pam, which is it means you don't get access. It means you have poor health outcomes, because it's not just a poor health outcome. You have to go right back to the stereotypes and the discrimination. It's a circle, and you'll see that in that infographic. It shows what precisely is present operating in the healthcare system in BC today. Maybe your listeners will find it in their own systems as well, but it is, racism is alive and well in the British Columbia healthcare system, and it must be rooted out. It must be eradicated.
Well, and this, your report really goes to this myth, you know, in any kind of system, that, well, there's always going to be one or two bad apples, but it's not system wide. And what your report shows is, this isn't even one, two, three, or four bad apples, that this really is a serious problem, and not just a, you know, political problem in the sense of people being offended. This can have significant health impacts on people, or even risk their lives.
Yeah, and I think that was, and again, you know, I've done a lot of work over the years in the child welfare system, in the justice system, like very high stakes systems where there's been mistreatment and racism. So it's not like I have never seen this. But when it came into the healthcare system is about taking care of health, mm-hmm. right? It's supposed to be the positive system. Whereas like in child welfare, we know how awful it's been. in justice, we know how, like, you know, when I was a judge on the provincial court in Saskatchewan, it was just being cheek to jowl with racism every day, you know? So it was like so difficult. It was like going to the band office, going to the provincial court, and the worst things would happen. So I'd been through tough systems where I know like how it feels to be in those systems. In this healthcare review, people told me I would rather die than go back to that hospital. And it would be like a woman with treatable breast cancer, you know? And so what really got me upset, and this is where I worked a lot with the colleges of physicians, surgeons, nurses, everyone got a really engaged here to say, you realize this is what happens, is people will not come to your get care because at the point of care, it's been so bad. They are choosing not to get a treatable issue with treatment that should be a positive thing. Like, we're going to address it. We're going to get you back on your feet. We're a team. We're going to listen. We honor and respect you. They're choosing not to do that. And even in everything, like whether it's the transplant program, whether it's treatable vascular issues, whether it's cancers, and at first I was like, is this person being kind of like dramatic? You know, like, is this just one dramatic case? And then I had hundreds of cases where people said, because of this, including I had a case, an 86-year-old Indigenous man, First Nations man, who doesn't have the internet, but he did the survey and followed the whole process. And he's like, you know, I've experienced this my whole life. And I'm so glad. He says, it's a miracle I'm still alive because I've avoided that place because it was so awful. And he said, in part, I wonder if I'm alive today because I avoided it. But I'm like, well, no, you're not. You're just genetically fortunate, because if someone does get breast cancer, they need to get treatment. We can't lose loved ones with treatable conditions because the racism and the ownership for that racism. Indigenous people said to me, Pam, so strongly, they said, Mary Ellen, take that racism, give it back to where it belongs. Get it off our shoulders. Like, why do we have to carry it? Throw it right back, and then let's actually talk about what really is cultural safety, because cultural safety needs anti-racism tools. And anti-racism tools means understand when you have these beliefs and behaviors and systems that have normed it. So we've started to peel that back. But the evidence, Pam, the preponderance of evidence is overwhelming, overwhelming. And that's just one province.
And we know, I mean, we hear incidents in Quebec, in Ontario, Manitoba, Saskatchewan. And I guess the thing that really concerns me is, you know, everyone's focused on, you know, racism and violence in policing. And so many Native women won't call the police for fear that they'll be arrested or assaulted. And they won't call social workers because they fear that their children will be taken. They don't call psychologists or counselors because what if they are deemed to be a danger to their children, and then their children are taken away and they can't go to the hospital. It seems like all of the institutions that were set up to care for, protect, support, and assist Indigenous peoples, if you look at it on a total, it's really limiting to Indigenous peoples, that we don't have the same access. So even if you never go to that hospital because of the racist experience, you're not going to have any of that really life-saving healthcare. And we know from the statistics and the things that you said in your report that we already have disproportionate socioeconomic and health indicators, you know, from this long history and continuation of, you know, these colonial practices. But if the caring professions, if the do no harm professions are not caring and doing harm, that concerns me for all Indigenous peoples, but especially for Indigenous women and children, because there's, you know, there's very particular nuances around that. And I know you just, you know, talked about it a little bit, but I'm wondering if you could share a little bit more about, you know, the very particular ways that Indigenous women are mistreated. So it's not just, you know, race-based, but it's also this kind of misogynistic idea that's added on top of that.
Yeah, that was really an interesting finding. And again, and I would also say, Pam, that one of the reasons why we're able to do the work we did and the work that's now going to have to happen is because the minister and the government in British Columbia which have a lot to answer for, of course, they were prepared to do this. They said, let's have a comprehensive review. And when they saw the evidence, they also said, this is racism. Like, and I've noticed in some provinces like Quebec, the premier refuses, right? And that is really toxic, because when you deny people's experiences and you are not, because you do the, I'm not a racist, like, that's not what we're talking about here. So like your example about women, I want to say that so many of the, you know, citizens that engaged with me during the process were Indigenous women. As soon as we opened the lines to say, we want to hear from you, guess what? Thousands of women were like, by the way, I'm like 45. I have 5 kids. I have grandchildren. I've been trying to navigate this system for everyone. And my own personal health care has been totally compromised by this. And they gave me like detailed information about how, as women, they have faced additional barriers. And so I'll give you one example, Pam, that's a bit shocking and I've been debriefing on right now, which is we have a women's hospital in Vancouver. It's one of the premier world-class women's hospitals in North America, and it's associated to the university. When I looked at emergency care, Indigenous women are 11 times more likely than any other women to leave emergency against medical advice, okay? That is not just because Indigenous women don't want medical help. It's because they are not safe in that environment. They are not receiving care. So that's our premier hospital. We don't have, for instance, an Indigenous women's reproductive health resource for the entire province. We don't have a perimenopausal, menopausal, or postmenopausal specialty. A lot of women are living with issues that are treatable issues around their reproductive health, okay? They've had children, they have bladder issues, they have like things where they're not able to work because they have treatable conditions and don't get treatment. So that whole piece, we have a premier women's hospital with no Indigenous women's specialty. We have started midwifery through the First Nations Health, and that's coming along, but I'm talking about women throughout the lifespan. So there's no like provincial expert resource that Indigenous women can call to make up for the barriers of the past, because we know Indigenous women have been so shamed, right? 60 Scoop, how did that happen? Because Indigenous women were shamed to say, you're pregnant, you're worthless, like you're sexually done now, we're taking your children. Today, for Indigenous women, and a lot of women who have had done survival sex work that I engaged with around this review, they had some of the worst treatment. And they are in Vancouver, right? And I tell the story of one woman, she was a survival sex worker back in her 20s, she's now in her 50s. She thinks she has COVID, she's sick, and she has a really complex, she has a seizure disorder, she has a lot of health, serious health issues. She thinks she has COVID, she goes to one of our main hospitals for a COVID test. She says, I'm really scared I'm gonna die from COVID, because she's super scared because she's had bad experiences. So they section her under the Mental Health Act and take her over to the other hospital with the psych unit, with a police escort, where she sits for hours. And then the shrink says, well, no, you're not suicidal. I don't know why you're here. And she's like, well, I just want a COVID test. Then they release her at 4 o'clock in the morning to like take a cab back to her house in the downtown east side. She's been sexually assaulted by cab drivers in the past. She's really scared to get into a cab. She doesn't want to be on the street at 4 o'clock in the morning. Like, and she's like, Mary Ellen, this is what I'm dealing with. And, you know, she's like, I'm only going to talk to you because it's you. Like, I would never talk to people because all they say to me is, I'm not a racist. I don't do, like, she's this denial. But when you look at, she said, like, when you look at my life experience of what I've been through in my life, can I just now at this stage of my life receive compassionate care? And she said to me, there's something in that file of mine in that hospital. Every time I go in, it's like there's a purple dot or something in my file that says this is an angry Indigenous woman who makes up problems, but she has complex health issues and she doesn't get proper care. So she's been mistreated by pharmacists, by the hospital. Like, her story alone was a reason why not only our Indigenous women don't get care, but they're so poorly treated, they isolate and isolate. She's trying to network with other Indigenous women to get through this, but she just needs good health care. You know, safe, respectful healthcare. So for Indigenous women, I really, you know, this report really is about how Indigenous women are trying, despite the racism, to navigate a healthcare system that has had so much mistreatment in it. And is it fixable? Well, of course it's fixable, but you have to know, you have to be able to diagnose what the problem is to fix it. When you just keep denying to Indigenous women that, like, I don't know why you're saying that, that's not true. And, you know, are you sure you're not drunk? Are you sure you're not, like, it's like so invalidating. So I think the key point, Pam, is that, you know, do I say that every instance of healthcare in BC is racist? Is every interaction racist? I can't say everyone, but it could happen to anyone at any time. So the operating stereotypes, those abusive interactions, the avoidance of care, the hardest hit cohort of people, if you like, are Indigenous women. And Indigenous women, it's interesting, in that caregiving stage, especially that, and as they get older, it gets worse. Like, you would think as it gets older, it's okay, yeah, I'm gonna get better care, they understand my life story. It's actually worse for women that are grandparents and caregivers. So very distressing, but also very fixable.
Well, and that's the thing, is to understand that it is fixable, not to take, you know, what some pundits would say as, oh, it's just so big, it took 500 years to create this, it's going to take 500 years to fix it, when in fact, I don't think that's the case. I think if we just admit the problem and go to the root of it, and take the action that's required, that it is fixable. And I mean, that kind of leads us to some of the recommendations in your report. I know you can't share all of them, but what do you think are the most important ways to move forward on this?
Well, it's going to need a forceful move, right? So the first one is that issue we've been talking about, which is acknowledging at every level. And I you know, it's interesting. I said to the Minister of Health, you need to acknowledge if you sincerely believe this. And he's like, I'm overwhelmed. Like, he's like, this is unacceptable. And I'm glad we did this. There has to be an immediate fulsome apology. I cannot be a health minister with this. So he was extremely ethical. But then I said to him, you know, but don't absolve and apologize for the system, because at the point of care, where there is like a First Nation in Chilliwack, for instance, where they've had there should be proper apologies there. So there needs to be that piece of work that you do with First Nations people at the point of care and their nations, and begin to acknowledge, have proper protocol and ceremony to begin to say, we're going to work on this, we're going to stop this. That's a really powerful thing, because that can create safety. But the 24 recommendations go to these three things, three categories: the beliefs that lead to racism, okay, that are actively there. The behaviors, like, you have privileges in a hospital, you shouldn't have privileges if you can't deliver care in an anti-racist way. So pre-qualification should be understanding anti-racism tools and deal with this racism. And people will note that in the report, I talk about the more than 530 racist comments I got back from healthcare workers in the process. And then the third thing is systems. Systems have not been designed. There's no standard for what is cultural safety and humility. There's nothing measured. It's all ad hoc, episodic. Everybody says, oh, I did some online training, but actually it's like less than 1% of the healthcare workforce. And moreover, on the system side, there has not been sufficient hardwiring at the point of care. And even though we have a fantastic First Nations Health Authority, it's a little bit on the model of segregation too, right? Like, oh, we have a problem with First Nations, put it over there. Well, First Nations Health Authority administers benefits, like the uninsured services that they used to be called, and they're doing innovative work, absolutely. But they're not at the point of care. There's five health authorities, there's major hospitals, there's our schools. So the recommendations go to systems. And the one area I would comment on, Pam, is that, you know, the Indigenous healthcare workers in the system, more than half of them that engage with me said that they personally experienced racism in the workplace. So it's not a collegial workplace in which Indigenous people can easily work. And not only have they experienced racism, but some of them had career limiting racism, meaning there's a First Nations nurse who, it's like, wow, we got a great person here, we're going to tackle racism, you know, this. And then she's like, I'm experiencing racism. And by the way, I have had to take a medical leave because the stress has led to physical problems. Or I've decided to quit this profession because I can't take it. And so that dynamic of a safe workplace, the collegial environment, like, what are you talking about? Create a safe collegial environment. That's your obligation. Like, so anti-racism work in the collegial environment. And even with the report, I had to say to people, now don't read the report and go to the First Nations doctor tomorrow and say, I just read Mary Ellen's report. What do you think? Like, don't do that, right? Like, don't say, can you help me unpackage all my racist views? Like, so even how to handle this, it's we are, because of the pandemic, has shown this insidious racism and the need to work on it. So the recommendations are about systems, meaning leadership needs to address. Quality needs to be defined in law in BC. Quality means quality healthcare without racism. Anti-racism has to be put every single place we can put it. And I've said that in the province. I also think for the Canada Health Act and the federal side, I wasn't empowered by the feds, but I made some observations and sent it to them and said, you know, you care, you have a lot of levers on First Nations health. The federal government has all kinds of legal levers and funding levers to address racism. And until recently with the pandemic, they have never acknowledged that racism. So more recently they have, which I'm glad, but also as they start to take more seriously, I hope, the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, you know, Article 24 says you are, have a right to healthcare. Indigenous people have a right to healthcare without discrimination. And I actually took that Article 24 in BC that's adopted the UN Declaration. And even though we're in early days of transitioning and educating, I took that Article 24 to docs, nurses, and everyone and said, are you aware that this is the law of BC now? This is, you have to align your practice with this. Not we need to think about it later. It is the law. So when I look at the federal side, there's been a gap and an absence there. And I know they're having some national meetings on racism and healthcare.
Welcome back to CKUT. I'm Brian. You were just listening to Pamela Palmater's January 16th discussion with Mary Ellen Turpo-Lafont. It's part of Palmater's Warrior Life podcast. If you want to hear more, you can find all of the Warrior Life content at pampalmater.com.
And in news you can use, groups like the Center for Gender Advocacy, the Iskwayu Project, and Quebec Native Women and First Peoples Justice Center are turning their annual vigil for missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, trans, and Two-Spirit relatives into an online gathering. The commemoration will be on February 14th, and you can find more information at the Center for Gender Advocacy's Facebook page. Tomorrow, Saturday, local immigration advocacy group Solidarity Across Borders is hosting a demonstration to denounce deportations and to demand status for all. The grassroots group Immigrant Workers Center echoed similar calls this week. They say people without status have reported intimidation and harassment as Montreal City Police enforce curfew measures. That Status for All demonstration is at noon at Complexe Guy Favreau near Place des Armes Metro. The federal government announced today that flights to the Caribbean and Mexico will be suspended until April 30th. We'll have more information for you next week on Off the Hour about what these flight freezes mean in the context of Canada's December decision to restart their deportation courts.
And that's it for this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The team includes me, Brian Jefferson, Grace Cobbold, Sarah Jesmer, and Alice Wu. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department and send an email to newsintern@ckut.ca. You can also find us on Facebook. Search CKUT. We've also set up a voicemail box that you can call and let us know how you're doing in quarantine. That number is 514 448 4041, extension 7000.
The music that you heard in this episode and that you're listening to now is from Montreal-based producer and electronic artist Iron Galaxy. This is their remix of Achilles, part of a larger EP from PBR Street Gang and Throne of Blood. Stay with us, Cafe's coming up next.
CKUT. Ensemble de la nation québécoise. Nous devons agir avec force pour freiner la pandémie. Seuls les services essentiels demeurent offerts. Les rassemblements sont interdits. Il est défendu de quitter son domicile entre 20h et 5h le matin. Respectons le confinement et le couvre-feu pour éviter d'être infecté par le virus de la COVID-19. Pour protéger les travailleurs de la santé, nos proches et nos aînés. Car l'important, c'est la santé. Pour plus d'informations, visitez québec.ca/confinement. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Plus que jamais, les gestes simples sont notre meilleure protection pour lutter contre le virus. C'est pourquoi, en tout temps, il faut continuer de respecter les mesures sanitaires de base, comme maintenir la distanciation physique de 2 mètres, porter le masque et se laver les mains régulièrement. Les déplacements et les voyages sont à éviter. En cas de symptômes, il est important de se faire tester rapidement et de respecter les consignes d'isolement. Découvrez toutes les mesures en place à québec.ca/coronavirus. On continue de bien se protéger. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
I was born dead.